Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, always a pleasure to talk to him, is professor at the University of North Carolina, writer, and founder of Ecotone, David Gessner. And we're talking about his latest book, The Book of Flacco, The World's Most Famous Bird. David, welcome back to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. We've interviewed several times.
Yeah, it's been a while, though. It's always good to be back in my hometown area.
This is a wild book. It's really interesting. I found it very compelling. And one of those things, I just sat down in a whole day and then just burned through the book, mainly because I'm a birder. And some of the overall issues you talk about are very pertinent to the way I feel about the, and that goes for the rest of your writing too. You're always concerned with how people think about and behave in what the so-called natural world. But why did you decide to do this book?
When or why?
Both.
Okay. Well, you know, I live in Wilmington, North Carolina, and have for 20 years. And my daughter grew up kind of on the beach, and she decided, for some reason we didn't understand, to go to NYU to school. Now, I'd never really lived or spent too much time in New York, but suddenly we were going there a lot. And weirdly, it turned out the next book I would write after Happy went to NYU and the next book my wife, as a novelist, would write, both were set in New York, which I see as a kind of parental not letting go. We had to follow it. And in fact, Hadley, I think I say in the book, much like Flacco, was electronically monitored by my wife, who follows her going home from bars in Greenwich Village at 2 a.m, on one of these phone apps. So I was up there a lot and started to look for Flacco, didn't find him, wasn't going to write about it. And then right after he died, I happened to be up there when he died in February of a year ago. And I thought, you know, this is an amazing story. Really doing it? You know, the New York Times is doing a kind of Flacco represented freedom, and there's a couple other pieces, but nobody was really doing anything. So I took a stab at calling up the main guy, David Barrett, who was in charge of Manhattan Bird Alert, where it has 100,000 followers. And he kind of tracked Flacco and guided people to him while he was in Central Park and beyond. And he took me out on a rainy morning and showed me the buildings on the Upper West Side where Flacco spent his last days. And I ran across the park, only partly because I needed to use the bathroom, to the Central Park Zoo. And I saw where the cage or the enclosure Flacco had been in. And it was way too small. But there was a maintenance guy there. And I kind of used, you know, Philip Roth said that not writing nonfiction in particular is the unseemly art. So I kind of pretended to the maintenance guy that I didn't know who Flacco was. And I was like, what's up with this owl? And sure enough, he spilled, you know, everything he knew. He said, oh, they must have, you know, because some people broke in, vandals, and freed him.
And that's how, and this is a huge eagle owl. It's the largest, I think, the largest bird of prey in Europe, or one of the largest birds of prey in Europe. It's not native to North America. It was in this horrible cage in Central Park. However, it was not a wild bird to begin with. It was the offspring of other captive birds from another zoo. It gets loose and it turns into this phenomenon. Not just, it starts in Central Park, but the bird leaves the Central Park area a bunch of times, and it just created this thing where people became mesmerized by the appearances of Flacco.
Yeah, thank you. You just did the work I should have done instead of racing ahead into the narrative. That's right. So in February of 2023, some vandals or liberators, depending on your take, cut a hole in the cage. Flacco makes his way down Fifth Avenue, can barely fly, doesn't hoot, you know, because he's been in this cage for pretty much his whole life. And he makes it into a tree in front of the famous La Plaza, famous hotel. And the next day he gets he flies over into Central Park, and he'll spend the next 7 or 8 months in Central Park. And as he does, people start following him, both in person and with their binoculars and online on their computers. And he becomes kind of this media star. So you'll have, you know, you have 100 people looking at him in person, and then you'll have media looking at the people who are looking at him, and then you'll have people watching online. So not only does he is he kind of a symbol of the urban wild, but he's a symbol for me of the world of screens that we live inside. So that's kind of the overview.
But it's really crazy because you do interview a bunch of people. I mean, this is a really a great piece of journalism and field reporting. But it's, I didn't even know how to describe, he became, a phenomena. People wrote about him. People took these pictures. There were people arguing about this stuff, but there were many different issues that were going on at the same time. First of all, he's not a wild bird that's now free. It's not that simple. He's a captive bird that got loose, and he's in his non-native environment trying to make a go of it. And
potentially threaten native species as well. So that's another part.
I think if they were breeding, maybe. But generally, the problem is that he wasn't eating interesting native species. He was eating pigeons and rats. But the problem is, I mean, there was such a big to-do about he's free and became the symbol of freedom. And then people started really getting on the zoo. Talk to me about the attitudes towards the zoo.
Well, early on, when he first gets free and he's starting to, you know, try to adapt, having a hard time at first, the zoo vows to capture him. And pretty much everybody backs that, because at that time, it didn't look like Flacco could take care of himself. But a big moment comes fairly quickly, within a couple of weeks, when he coughs up a pellet, which signifies that he's eaten something somehow. And the next day, or the next couple of days later, they see him hunting and catching a rat. So that's a game changer right there. You know, now he suddenly maybe can take care of himself. So maybe they don't have to recapture him. And gradually, the sentiment grows that keep Flacco free. The better Flacco does, the more people are like, let him have this time free. Now, the zoo is caught in a bit of a jam.
Oh, yeah.
PR jam. They also, as they try to capture him, they have to really be careful they don't hurt him, since, you know, he's on the world stage, basically, and everybody's going to see it. And when they finally decide to kind of cave to the Free Flacco folks, they withdraw. And here's where I think, I understand why they did it, but here's where I think they made a mistake. They withdrew almost completely, and they were very quiet. They didn't respond, you know, and what they could have done, had they had more boldness and imagination, was take a lead in the Flacco phenomenon, have a zoo person, a zoo worker out there with the groups following him, who could say just what you said earlier, that Eurasian eagle owls are the largest owls, could tell people about them and tell, you know, their habits, they're nocturnal. And by doing that, they would have had kind of a movable zoo.
Right.
They would have fulfilled the idea, you know, the zoo's mission, particularly at inner city zoo, is to entertain, of course, but also to educate and to bring people who don't usually get contact with wild animals in contact. So here they had that chance to do it. I totally understand why they didn't. And maybe I'm being a little Pollyannish, but it would have been a brilliant move, because, you know, people were following him anyway and behaving well for the most part, but occasionally misbehaving and getting too close and scaring Flacco off during the day when a nocturnal bird wants to sleep.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many questions that come out in your book about this. First of all, people really develop a lot of bad feelings towards the zoo. And the other thing,
and I want each other, because it's Twitter, and you know, it was Twitter halfway through.
Well, you know, you were talking about David Barrett. Well, because he would post every time the bird was perched and seen, and people would just flock out there. People started getting on his case, saying that, you know, that's not a great way to treat a raptor, continuing making it the focus of everybody's attention, and it inevitably people behave badly. I mean, every time I've seen a wild owl, like a great gray out of, here in Massachusetts, or a boreal owl or something like that, inevitably photographers get too close and flush it out, right, and do all sorts of work.
Or when we have snowy owl eruptions.
Oh, like, God. And you talk about that in the book. I mean, I've never seen such bad behavior within New England. You see it a lot in the big national parks out west, where people are walking right up to a bear and her cub trying to take a photo. But it was just amazing. I mean, hundreds of people, sometimes at a time, would be watching this owl. And when he left, I thought he was going to take off eventually, like just go book into the long-term woods, like up in upstate New York or something. But he stayed in the area.
Yeah. Well, I will say this in defense of David Barrett, is that the other rift that I talk about is that between like old school birders and kind of the new birders who really started to blossom or become big during the pandemic. But a lot of people, particularly in New York, that was one of their only outlets, is to get in Central Park. So, you know, the old school rule was don't reveal the daytime location of an owl.
That's still true here.
Right. However, as I said, the genie was already out of the bottle on that one.
And it wasn't a native owl.
It wasn't a native owl, and people were going to be, you know, it was getting out. So all David did really was, you know, organize it and, you know, kind of, and he himself was well behaved. But of course, like you said, you can't always. Hey, by the way, I don't know if you caught that reference to Wachusett Reservoir.
I did.
Lived near there. And that was one of my, you know, what I tried to do. I am not like a group birder. I've always been more of the Thoreauvian solitude type. And I kind of list throughout some of my own wild encounters. And of course, one of them was just walking down a hill toward the reservoir and having a great horn just come right over my shoulder.
I know.
And not hearing it until it was right there. Because of course they're, you know, the whisper wings, the silent wings. And then I happened to be lucky enough to be on Cape Cod during the eruption, I think in 2018.
And yeah, it was right around there. We even had them here in Worcester.
Yeah, that's great.
But you know, I don't know what it is about owls. I mean, that could be a whole other book, but raptors in general, people have this thing. If it was something like a varied thrush or something, there would be a lot of birders showing up, but not a lot of other people. Flacco really just sort of captured a lot of people's imaginations.
Let me give you two examples, because I went charging off at the beginning of our talk, but what I was going to get to is after I went to the zoo, when this maintenance guy was kind of helping me out. And as I say in the book, he was kind of my deep throat.
Story,
because he was like, oh, they used a grinding tool to get, you know, it came in this way. So it was like probably more than the zoo said the whole time was what this guy said to me that day. But then I went home. As I get older, I always take a nap. My dream time is 3:18. So I went to my hotel in New York. And while I was on the way, I texted with this woman, Nan Knighton. And that night, she greeted me at the door with a cocktail and a hug. And she showed me the place in her. She had an amazing apartment on Fifth Avenue. And she showed me the place in the kitchen where one day around Halloween, a little after Halloween, Flacco landed at a window and stared in with his blazing orange eyes and stared in for 3 hours. And she wasn't a birder or a nature person, but she found it a life-changing experience.
Isn't it amazing?
And she was a writer. She's a playwright. So she was writing about it, thinking about it. And then a month later on Thanksgiving, her daughters kept looking over at her and pointing. And she said, what is it? What is it? And one of them said, you sure talk about that bird a lot. Like, you're obsessed. And in a way, that's what so many New Yorkers ended up doing, is becoming kind of obsessed with this bird. And you ask about the appeal of an owl. Well, and part of it is that forward facing, the eyes, the very human face in terms of the eyes. And then also the inhuman aspect of the just sheer spooky intensity of it, the largest eyes of any bird and just like blazing at you. You know, I had some experience later in the year, having a staring contest with an owl, and it was crazy. It was intense.
It is amazing because they have those forward looking eyes. But it's also, I think, one of the other aspects is owls in general are not commonly seen because they're nocturnal, most of the species. So when you do see an owl, it's a big deal. It's really a huge thing. But to see one of these, first of all, the coloring on the owl on Flacco is just, it's really different. It's not like the gray color of most of the owl, gray brown of all the owls we see around here. It's got these spectacular orange eyes too. They're just amazing. So it is a spectacular thing. But when you started interviewing people and people talked about how the experience like changed them internally, I mean, they felt like they had an experience with nature. But then that really makes you ask, like, what does nature mean to humans, and what is it? And it's not an easy question. What? You know?
Well, I grew up in Worcester, so by nature, I'm a little skeptical. Right? and at first, I didn't really buy it entirely. And the more I talked to them, like when he died a year after he escaped, I mean, it took me a while to believe people were legitimately mourning.
Oh yeah,
really.
Oh yeah,
it was life changing for them, and. You know, and like you said, they really cared about the bird and they followed it every day. And so, I mean, the book is about Flacco for sure, but it's also about people and their obsessions. And what did he represent? You know, we're talking about freedom. At one point, I say he also represented space and breaking out of the cage. You know, we all feel, like I said, we live in a world of screens. But just think of the assault of email and every bell's going off and warnings and everything. So he kind of represented for me wildness and breaking out. And I've had some experience with the urban wild before. I lived at Cambridge the year my daughter was born, and I followed this guy, John Way, who was a coyote tracker. And one day we went out on the Charles River, which had iced over, and there was like a talcum powder snowfall. We followed the tracks of coyotes right down the Charles into the city, into Boston. And, you know, those moments, for some reason, when the urban wild is involved, when you're doing it within a city, it's even crazier and wilder. Like you're like, because it's such a surprise, right? It's a shock to.
Well, it's like an interloper. It's a little piece of wildness in a place that you don't expect to find it.
Exactly.
I remember we talked about those coyote sightings, but you know the situation is still different because in the case of coyotes, or in the case of peregrine falcons, say, these are wild animals that have now learned to coexist in a human environment. With Flacco, you got a bird that was a captive bird from birth, and definitely was part of an exhibition, and it gets loose. And my feeling would be I'm immediately afraid for him. He's not in his native, and you've seen these birds now in their native environment. We're going to not talk a lot about that because that's the way the book ends. But
yeah. Well, let's say something first about what you just said, which is, for me, the most exciting time is when Flacco starts to regain his like native skills. He
reintegrates
evolutionary tools. So people are like, this bird, is it going to be able, even when he was starting to catch rats, he was running along the ground. But then gradually we have this kind of reclaiming of those evolutionary skills, starting with flight. You know, at first he can only fly a little ways, but suddenly gradually he can swoop down and catch a rat in Central Park. Then we have him hooting, which he hadn't done at all back in the cage. And he's hooting down into neighborhoods later when he gets into the city, and he's hooting through Central Park. And then we have just kind of this, as some birders said, at first it was like a guy who has a Maserati but doesn't know how to drive. And then he learns to drive. So that moment of growth for me is one of the pivotal exciting points of the story, when he starts to get it, that I'm an owl.
Well, I especially loved it when he left Central Park. Even if he was on a water tower or a building outside of the park, or turning up on somebody's fire escape and stuff like that, it was like he was exploring, and that felt that was an interesting part of his short life there. You're listening to WICN 9.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is professor at the University of North Carolina, writer and founder of Ecotone, David Gessner. And we're talking about his latest book. It's a really mesmerizing read. It's The Book of Flacco, F-L-A-C-O, the world's most famous bird. But now we have to talk about the demise. because then that put a whole other spin on everything. Yeah. You know, everybody's earthy crunchy and everything's looking cool. And then he's suddenly found dead in an alleyway. And what did he die of?
Well, he died, you know, it's funny because to this moment, you have big newspapers. I won't name them, but they're located in New York. who say it was a building collision, right? And gradually let go of that narrative, but never quite got the narrative right. Once he broke it, you mentioned he around Halloween, he went down and explored the Lower East Side. Then later, he's in the Upper West Side, and he starts adding pigeons to his rat diet. Mm. And so he, in all likelihood, you know, he had 6 strains of rat poison, so that probably didn't kill him, but it weakened him. And then he had pigeon herpesvirus from pigeons, which probably was the definitive cause of death. He had taken to spending his days hiding out in like courtyard in the Upper West Side and then going into the park to hunt sometimes at night. And so he was found in an Upper West Side courtyard, and that's a fancy word for what's really just a concrete backyard. And he was found on the ground. And what happened was he was perched, and he was weakened by those 2 other things. And he fell, he hit a video camera on the way, and then his contusions were from the ground. So it was what people thought at first were those contusions were the result of colliding with a building. Now, 1 billion birds a year die from building collisions, so it's not an uncommon thing. And in a cool way, Flacco had a Rachel Carson aspect, because after he died and people thought it was a building collision, laws started passing about turning lights down in buildings so they wouldn't collide. And also, and this is more legitimate results of Flacco's death, there are now a couple neighborhoods in New York that are experimenting without using rat poison, but rat contraceptives, which are a little, you know, sterilizing pills in juicy rat nuggets, basically, that they eat and get, you know,
That amount of rat poison seems particular to New York, though. I don't think there's a rat poisoning program in Boston, for instance, that's anywhere near that level.
And rural places, so many bald eagles, so many snowy owls, you know, when they get autopsied or necropsied at the end, they, you know, they find they have strains of rat poison in them. So it's everywhere. And it's very, you know, it gets into the water, it gets into pets that eat these. You know, they drink the water or eat the rats, and you know, it's a mess.
But then it makes you realize, well, yeah, Flacco had his freedom, but because of where he was free, it killed him.
Right.
So was there a change in attitude when he was found dead and when it was found out what he died of, that people think that now maybe he should have been recaptured?
Some did, and some were pretty vicious about going after the people who had. They saw, you know, like the New York Post did a thing about, oh, those liberal softies who anthropomorphized Flacco.
Oh, yeah.
Now we get to what it's about. But you know, then people, once a little time passed, people started to ask the central question, which is a central question of the story, which is, what would you take if it were you? Would you take 1 year in the wild where you're outside the cage and flying?
Yeah.
Or would you stay safer in the cage?
And as you described it, the cage was ridiculously small.
Yeah. And even if it wasn't, you know, and you're alone in it, it seems a pretty miserable existence to me. I know what I'd take. I'd pretty much taken it. You know, I tell a story of like that in another book that starts when I bring my daughter to, when she's like 1 year old, I bring her to Walden and I point out, and she's up on my shoulders, and I point to the foundation of Thoreau's cabin. And I said to her, that's where the man lived who ruined daddy's life. And, you know, that was in high school. And then that pretty much being a doctor or a lawyer went out the window, and I chose this other strange route that I've taken.
By the way, that's a good recommendation for people. You should, not only should you read the book that we're talking about, but you should read all his other books because they're really interesting.
Thank you.
The one thing, we have like 2 minutes left. I just want to talk to you. No, I want to leave that for people to read. Okay. People need to read the book, but needless to, I'll just mention that you do, in fact, see genuinely wild eagle owls.
Yeah.
And that's a whole different experience. And that's the last part of the book. But I just want to mention your Caddyshack analogies did not sit well with me because I'm definitely a Judge Smales.
Yes, that's right. I felt like the common man birders, or, you know, the Rodney Dangerfield birders were one camp, and they were like, oh, let everybody come out. You know, we don't, you know, we'll get close to the owl. We'll show you the owl. And then the, you know, the Dobby birders,
the Rodney Dangerfields.
What, but who's Ted Knight?
Ted Knight is the Judge Smales. And you were talking about the contemporary rabble being more like Al Severnik. It's really funny because I actually have interviewed a person who wrote an entire book just about Caddyshack. And by the way, I'm Ted Knight, but I'm not obnoxious about it. But I am an older birder who believes you should not report the location of raptors that are nesting, especially. And what's weird about that is we just found out that there's a bald eagle nesting two blocks on Park Avenue in Worcester. Yeah, but we've already had problems with people and photographers. And I told you that. Get off my lawn.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's the return of the wild.
Yeah. Well, I'm totally into that. It is amazing. I live in the city. I've had coyotes. I've had foxes. I've had a moose walk down the street. It was pretty weird. But those are stories for other time, David. I just hope you keep writing because every book you write, I really found fascinating and interesting. My returning guest tonight is professor at the University of North Carolina, writer and founder of Ecotone, David Gessner. Trust me, read his other books too. And we've been talking about his latest, The Book of Flacco, the world's most famous bird. Hey, David, I so love your writing. Keep writing. I
try to stay alive. That's my main goal.
Yeah, that's all of our main goals right now. It's like, yeah, especially like from COVID on, it's just one. Yeah, well, let's hope we're all around for your next book. Take it easy, David.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.